Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 524, titled The Safari Club and the Islamic Bomb. This is being recorded on August 28th of the year 2005. Now, we're going to continue with our account of how the Islamic Bomb, and specifically the Pakistani AQ Khan network, which has been quite a bit in the news media over the last couple of years, although not as much about that media, about that network has been in the media as should have been. We're going to take a look at how basically the Safari Club, an outsourcing of U.S. intelligence to Saudi Arabia, was ultimately responsible for the development of the AQ Khan network and the Islamic Bomb. It is apparent already from what we've seen that the AQ Khan network was allowed to proceed forward in exchange for the Saudi GID, that's the Saudi Intelligence Service, the Pakistani ISI, and their agreement to work as proxies for the CIA in helping to support the Afghan Mujahideen. As we saw in For the Record 522, and as we reviewed briefly at the beginning of this program, the official rationale for the establishment of the Safari Club was to give U.S. intelligence a plausibly deniable and unverifiable operational capability during the congressional investigations of the mid-1970s. I suspect that the investigation that most disturbed the authors of the Safari Club was the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigating the Kennedy assassination, the John Kennedy assassination, that is, and the assassination of Martin Luther King. But the official rationale was because of the relatively tame Church Committee. I suspect that there were other motivations for the establishment of the Safari Club, including a decision that I think was made among the world's power elites and elements associated with the Underground Reich to basically farm out what was left of American democracy and to pretty much reduce the United States to what it is now, a name and a series of properties being bought out and utilized and eventually liquidated by foreign interests. Recall that at the root of the Reagan administration, at the root of both George's Bush, and at the root of the Saudi Club, of the Safari Club and Saudi Arabia, lies the Third Reich and its post-war underground mafia-like component, what I call the Underground Reich, the greatest concentration of economic power under a single control in world history, as a banker told the late Paul Manning, author of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, a text available for free on the Spitfire website. Now, we're going to return for our account of how the Safari Club and those elements of U.S. intelligence that were working with it, basically the Reagan and Bush administrations, and really both Bush administrations, because it appears basically that George W. Bush is picking up the residua of the Safari Club and working with it. We're going to take a look at how the Safari Club and its participation in the Afghan Mujahideen support effort against the Soviets in the 1980s, which of course spawned Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. We're going to take a look at how that also spawned the AQ Khan network and the Islamic Bomb, continuing with the tale that we began. We're going to turn once again to Prelude to Terror, subtitled The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. That was authored by Joseph J. Trento, published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff. We resume with our narrative. By the way, this is a book I can't recommend strongly enough. We resume with our narrative. By 1985, the Saudi royal family had succeeded in drawing the United States into an Islamic morass. Over the years, the Wahhabi sect, a radical form of anti-Western Islam, had increasingly caused the high-living royal family political problems at home. To deal with this, the royal family gave the Wahhabi leaders free rein and paid lip services to their diatribes against the West and Israel. But after the fall of the Peacock Throne in Iran, religious division surfaced within the royal family, contributing to a schizophrenia in Saudi Arabia's foreign policy. With one hand, the Saudis supported the secular Saddam Hussein against the Islamic regime in Iran, and with the other, they dispatched Osama bin Laden and others as members of the Saudi intelligence to work with the most radical Islamic elements fighting to secure control of Afghanistan. The anti-communist Reagan-Bush policymakers focused only on the goal of weakening the Soviet Union, ignoring the threat of radical Islam. The efforts by the Saudis, Reagan, Casey, and Bush to destabilize the Soviet Union through the war in Afghanistan carried a huge price in terms of both money and the number of Afghan lives lost. Hundreds of millions of dollars poured into Pakistani intelligence from the United States, with almost no control on how the funds were spent. The same BCCI bank accounts being used to fund the Afghan resistance were also used to fund the Pakistani nuclear bomb program, according to a Senate report on BCCI. The Reagan-Bush policy violated both American law and international non-proliferation treaties. But this type of violation was not unprecedented. The United States had allowed covert aid to Israel to help with their nuclear weapons program in the late 1950s and early 1960s. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson had given James Angleton permission to assist Israel in further developing its nuclear weapons program. Now, the Reagan administration was leveling the playing field. The Saudis claimed that Israel had directly aided India in developing its program and had thus created a dangerous imbalance in the region. Allowing Pakistan to develop a weapon but not to deploy it seemed like a workable compromise and, the Saudis argued, the only solution. The 1979 memo from Zbigniew Brzezinski to President Carter, suggesting how the Soviet Union could be trapped in Afghanistan, had warned that the price of luring the Soviets might include abandoning efforts to stop nuclear proliferation in Pakistan. Just 6 years later, the Reagan-Bush team played a huge role in making the first Islamic nuclear weapon possible. By the mid-1980s, so much money was flowing through the Pakistani ISI that the CIA did not have a handle on where it was going, according to Melvin Goodman, a former CIA analyst on the Soviet Union. Quote, "They were funding the wrong Islamic groups," unquote, said Goodman, again quoting, "and had little idea where the money was going or how it was being spent," unquote. Sarkis Sognalian, who profited from providing arms for the secret aid program, put it bluntly, quote, "As in Iraq, the U.S. did not want to get its hands dirty. So the Saudis' money and the U.S. money was handled by ISI. I can tell you that more than three-quarters of the money was skimmed off the top. What went to buy weapons for the Afghan fighters was peanuts," unquote. According to Sognalian, the funds were first laundered through various BCCI accounts before being dispersed to ISI and into an elaborate network being run by A.Q. Khan. Quote, "Khan's network was controlled by the Saudis, not by Khan, and not by Pakistan," Sognalian said. "The Saudis were in on every major deal, including Iran, Libya, North Korea, and Malaysia," unquote. After two decades of silence on Pakistan's nuclear proliferation network, the CIA went public in 2004, taking credit for uncovering the network. After A.Q. Khan's bizarre confession, apology, and subsequent pardon, quote, "There was never any kind of authorization for these activities by the government," Khan said on Pakistani television, again quoting, "I take full responsibility for my actions and seek your pardon," unquote. The CIA claimed that it successfully exposed Pakistan's nuclear efforts. In fact, Khan's network was only the tip of a huge nuclear technology iceberg. The truth of how much the CIA and the private intelligence network knew in the 1980s and what their actual role might have been is suggested by a pair of criminal cases, one in London and one in Houston. In each case, the defendant received very kind treatment from authorities who allowed the nuclear proliferation network to continue operating. Now note, as we go into the account of Nazir Ahmed Vaid, last name V-A-I-D, that his activities were not only winked at by the private network, the Safari Club, acting as an extension of and proxy for U.S. intelligence, and one of the foundational elements of the fifth column that I've discussed so often in connection with September 11th. Notice how this fellow's activities continued even after September 11th. Note also how he was able to fund some of his nuclear technology acquisition on behalf of Pakistan and the Islamic bomb through the BCCI. And as we've looked at in so many broadcasts about September 11th, the BCCI milieu is the milieu that spawned September 11th. And the degree of connection between the BCCI milieu and that of September 11th could not be exaggerated. Continuing. In June of 1984, U.S. federal agents arrested Nazir Ahmed Vaid, a 33-year-old Pakistani, as he attempted to smuggle out of Houston 50 high-speed electronic switches of a kind used to trigger nuclear bombs. At the time of the arrest, U.S. Customs agents seized several letters directly linking Vaid to S.A. Butt, B-U-T-T, the director of Pakistan's Atomic Energy Commission. Butt was already known to U.S. and European arms control officials as the key operative in Pakistan's successful attempts in Europe in the 1970s to obtain the technology and resources for the enrichment of uranium and the reprocessing of plutonium, unquote. Vaid reportedly offered to pay for the switches in gold, later determined to have been supplied by BCCI. U.S. federal officials, however, never informed the prosecutors that the letters connected Vaid to the Pakistani bomb program. Instead, a very special deal was worked out. Vaid ultimately pleaded guilty to one count of illegally attempting to export the switches, known as Krytrons, without a license. U.S. District Judge James DeAnda sentenced Vaid to 5 years probation, the minimum possible sentence. At Vaid's sentencing, both Judge DeAnda and the prosecutor agreed that Vaid was not a foreign agent. DeAnda described him as a businessman, quote, trying to expedite what he thought was a business deal, unquote. Just 3 weeks later, Vaid was deported. According to Seymour Hersh, Arnold Raphael, R-A-P-H-E-L, who served as the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, later revealed that there had been a fix-in on the Vaid case and that the CIA had arranged for the matter to be handled quietly. Because of his conviction and deportation, Vaid was prohibited from returning to the United States. His name appears on a U.S. Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, database of banned individuals. Nevertheless, according to an ICE spokesman, Vaid has entered the country more than a half dozen times during the past several years. By simply dropping his last name and becoming Nazir Ahmed, Vaid fraudulently obtained multiple visas from the U.S. State Department, according to ICE. And fraudulently here is in quotes, as well it should be. Note now the activities of Vaid and his associates after September 11th. During his recent visits, some after the September 11th, 2001 attacks, Vaid has established in Texas a string of companies with foreign affiliations. Three in particular stand out. On July 22, 2002, Vaid, using the name Nazir Ahmed, and his brother, Mohammed Iqbal Vaid, incorporated Najud Trading Incorporated and Idafa Investments Incorporated. The sole shareholder in Najud is a company of the same name based in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. The Emirates are known to have been used as a transshipment point by the Khan network. The Dubai company identifies itself as being engaged in, among other things, building service materials trading, construction materials trading, roofing materials, and accessories, unquote. The directors of the Texas company are Nazir Ahmed and Ahmed Ali, whose address is the same as that of the Dubai parent company. The sole shareholder in Idafa Investments is an Islamic investment firm of the same name based in Mumbai, India. The website for the parent company identifies it as a broad-based investment advisory and management firm that operates on Quranic principles. The founder of the Indian company is listed as Ashraf Abdul Haq Mohammadi. One of the directors of the Texas company is Ashraf Abdul Haq Mohammadi. That's M-O-H-A-M-E-D-Y. Continuing. The others are Mohammad Ashraf Abdul Haq Mohammadi, Mohammad Sikh Vaid, and, quote, Nazir Ahmed, unquote. Parenthetically, obviously, this is basically pretty much the same little group of individuals, that grouping about two people. Continuing. The Indian Company's website provides a link to Islamic Quest, an organization, quote, established to present the correct position of Islam to non-Muslims, unquote. The contact person for Islamic Quest is listed as Ashraf Abdulhaq Mohammadi. Mohammed Vaid signed the incorporation papers both for Najud and Idafa on the same day, July 19, 2002, and before the same notary public. On that same day and before the same notary, Nazir Ahmed, unquote, signed the incorporation papers for yet another company, MEC Enterprises USA, Incorporated. The signature above the printed words Nazir Ahmed appears to simply read Vaid, unquote. The sole shareholder in the company is MEC Engineering Networks Private Limited of Faisalabad, Pakistan. MEC Engineering is a metals machining and manufacturing company. Its many functions, unquote, as listed on its website, include tanks, vessels, and shells, unquote, pharmaceutical machineries and equipment, unquote, wastewater treatment, unquote, and engineering pipeline construction, unquote. The owners of MEC Engineering are Abdul Qavi Qureshi and Abdul Majid Qureshi. The directors of the Texas subsidiary MEC Enterprises are Nazir Ahmed, unquote, and Mohammed Aslam Qureshi of Karachi. As recently revealed, Khan's middleman, BSA Tahir, helped establish a subsidiary of a Malaysian metal machining company and use it to manufacture parts for high-speed centrifuges for enriching uranium. The parts were transshipped through Tahir's Dubai-based front companies to end users such as Libya. The first known U.S. company the Vaid set up following Nazir's deportation was Finatra Communications Incorporated. That company was incorporated by a third party, Amin M. Ali of Houston, Texas, in August of 1996. The shareholders were Mohammed Vaid, 20%, and Nazir Ahmed, unquote, parenthetically, and the senior Vaid, 80%. Both listed residential addresses in Houston. In 1999, the Vaids changed the name of the company to Finatra Group of Companies. Nazir Vaid also operates a branch of Finatra in Pakistan. A 1997 article in Pakistan and Gulf Economist refers to Nazir Ahmed Vaid, unquote, as the chief executive of Finatra's Cyber Cafe in Karachi, Pakistan, reportedly the first such establishment in that country. The parent of the Cyber Cafe is the Finatra Group of Companies, also based in Karachi. Finatra Group controls several businesses, including a web hosting service, an energy generation company, phone and cell phone rental agencies, and a prepaid calling card dealer called Finatra Communications Private Limited. In 1998, Finatra Communications signed a contract with Pakistan's official phone company, Pakistan Telecommunication Company Limited, to provide prepaid phone card service in Pakistan. The service also allows direct international dialing. All of these businesses could be useful to an intelligence service or a terrorist organization. In 2004, U.S. Customs was planning to detain Vaid on his next trip to the United States after being warned by a reporter that Vaid was traveling freely between the U.S. and Pakistan. In the fall of 2004, a U.S. Customs agent inexplicably told Vaid's son that there was a detention order out on his father. That incident raises major questions about Vaid's relationship with the United States government and about security in the Customs Service. According to an ICE spokesman, Vaid last left the United States on November 1, 2002. More than one CIA source said that Nazir Vaid is a CIA, quote, asset, unquote. In a telephone interview, Vaid flatly denied working for U.S. or Pakistani intelligence. He also insists he is not engaged in the trade or shipment of nuclear technology. The George W. Bush administration expresses shock at the fact that Pakistan's declared Islamic The George W. Bush administration expresses shock at the fact that Pakistan's declared Islamic bomb program became just that, a pan-Islamic nuclear weapons supermarket. This is the same Bush administration that, in an eerily familiar move, just 2 weeks after the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, lifted the sanctions that had been imposed by the Clinton administration on Pakistan because of its nuclear weapons activities. The Bush change was to win Islamabad's assistance in the new war in Afghanistan, the War on Terrorism, unquote. Note parenthetically, Joseph J. Trento puts the War on Terrorism in quotes. Some of what you've been hearing here perhaps indicates the wry irony underlying his use of the quotes here. Continuing. This is also the same administration that publicly, at least, accepts A.Q. Khan's absurd confession that he is responsible personally and not as an agent of the Pakistani government for disseminating nuclear weapons know-how to North Korea, Iran, and Libya. The fact that the United States had protected the Islamic bomb program also emerged in the Edwin Wilson case. During the time Wilson was a fugitive, the former CIA frontman sent the Reagan White House and the CIA detailed information about the Libyan nuclear program. The memorandum sent from Wilson in Libya through his lawyers to Theodore Shockley and the National Security Advisor. The memorandum went from Wilson in Libya through his lawyers to Theodore Shockley and the National Security Advisor. Wilson would later say he was never asked or questioned about what he had learned about the Libyan nuclear program. Unquote. A really scary passage there in the second half. Well, it all was really pretty scary and kind of depressing and more than a little infuriating. Listeners who find the recitation of the tangled name of front companies and so forth should be aware that those networks were set up precisely to be opaque and not transparent. The whole idea was basically the execution of a nuclear covert operation. So if some of that sounds complicated, undecipherable, that's what it's supposed to be. When I've got the description for the Record 524 up on the web, you'll be able to read about it so you can piece that together. Or I would recommend go out and get a copy of Prelude to Terror by Joseph J. Trento, a really important book. It'll be particularly resonant with long-time listeners to my work, people going back to the old One Step Beyond and RFA era of the 1980s will recognize the many, many, many discussions of the Edwin Wilson, Theodore Shockley, Thomas Klein's network, and their various Cuban associates, the Villaverde brothers, Rafael Chichi Quintero, and others. That is the network talked about here. And if indeed there is a smoking gun that's a mushroom cloud, as Condi Rice was talking about, unfortunately, this network, the Safari Club, one of the principal elements in the underground Reich Fifth Column network I've spoken about so often, will be a key element in its formation. One of the things that I want to underscore here is that one should not oversimplify intelligence matters. The whole issue of undercover agents, double agents, triple agents is a complicated one. Basically, intelligence, espionage, is the art of deception. And often, who's zooming who is not the easiest thing to figure out. Often, a lot of the most skilled intelligence operatives are sociopaths of one type or another. One of the things that makes them so good at deception is basically they have no real loyalties except to themselves. Sometimes they can very effectively deceive their employer, and sometimes they switch sides. If they see the winds blowing in a different direction politically and or economically, they decide to basically go with the apparent winner. And one of the mistakes that this country has made, or at least those elements that keep that are intent on preserving democracy, is they basically have trusted, they backed the wrong horse. so to speak. I have not got the article in front of me, but at some point in the future I will be discussing the fact that due to the enormous increase in oil prices, the Saudis are going to be increasing dramatically their purchases in foreign countries, not only the United States, but elsewhere in the United States, and they have already purchased a company called OSAN, O-S-A-N, that is one of the principal companies involved with counting the votes assembled by the Republican-controlled voting machine companies such as ESNS and Diebold. So the residua of this Safari Club are going to be increasingly involved in counting what are left of a sincerely, quote, democratic, unquote, voting in the United States, that with a small D. Now, if some of the things that I talk about on this, or you've heard on this broadcast, seem difficult to comprehend, if the approach is too pedantic, well, in addition to getting a hold of the book Prelude to Terror by Joseph J. Trento, which I recommend, I don't get any money from that, by the way, there will be a detailed article-length description of For the Record 524 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or two of the airing of this broadcast. Those descriptions are long, article-length pieces of work, and that's done basically so the admittedly pedantic format of this program can become a little more accessible to listeners. Also, please get in the habit of using those descriptions, emailing them to others. There is a listener back east who is turning the descriptions into a blog spot. WFMU, the heroic sister station WFMU, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. The entire series is available on Real Audio. The last 250-plus shows are on streaming Real Audio at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only. More recent shows are also available on MP3. WFMU is podcasting the For the Record shows as well, so you can have the For the Record broadcast podcast to you by WFMU. www.spitfirelist.com, the website for the CD duplication service that handles all of the work that I'm doing. There's a wealth of material there, too. In addition to the increasingly voluminous For the Record descriptions, there are descriptions of the other programs and lectures that I've done. The last several For the Record shows are available on both MP3 and Real Audio on the Spitfire website. That for download only. They're not streaming. There is a search function on the Spitfire website, so you can search for material so that you can build up your understanding of current programs by accessing some of the references in past broadcasts. There's also a link to a website maintained by listeners in the Midwest who have compiled the declassified U.S. government documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. There is also the entire Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile book, a pivotally important and suppressed book, available on both Adobe PDF and also on HTML. And last but certainly not least, there's a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. If you don't like what you're hearing here, there's no better way to do something about it than support the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 524, The Safari Club and the Islamic Bomb, being recorded on August 28th of the year 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.